A few months ago, I was part of a TIPS program. So TIPS being a transition in practice program. The program was designed for nurses like me who have years of experience in acute and intermediate care and transition us to become critical care nurses. Now, within the first few weeks in the ICU, a few things came up that were honestly pretty alarming to me, especially having to do with sedation and delirium, which I saw was rampant in my ICU. So I phoned a friend, Kaylee Dayton, who is an ICU nurse practitioner and self-proclaimed enthusiast for all things early mobility and delirium. Now, the first topic we talked about was part of the episode I released right before this one about a true, honest-to-God RAS score, but this episode will be about spontaneous awakening trials, SATs, which is the daily process of removing sedation, hopefully coupled with a spontaneous breathing trial, to assess if a patient is appropriate for ventilator weaning. Just like the RAS score, what I was taught in the classroom about how to perform an SAT was so wildly different than what was actually being practiced in the ICU. So according to the PADIS guidelines, PADIS is pain, agitation, delirium, immobility, and sleep disruption. Daily SATs are the stopping of narcotics, as long as pain is controlled, and sedatives every day, and if needed, restarting either narcotics or sedatives at half the previous dose and titrating as needed. This seemed pretty straightforward to me, right? Like, we learn in the classroom that if a patient meets certain criteria, we once a day take off sedation, and then, if needed, reapply it at half the rate. But in practice, I saw something that looked like this. My preceptor reduced propofol by 5 mics, saw the patient's heart rate go up a bit, then declared that the patient wasn't tolerating it, went back up on the propofol saying, "It's just really not nice to have a tube stuck down your throat." After talking to Kaylee, I quickly realized that this half-hearted attempt at a spontaneous awakening trial is unfortunately quite common. And it all comes back to a fundamental misunderstanding of sedation as used in critical care today. And hey, I'm guilty of not really following every piece of protocol too, if I don't know why I'm being asked to do something. But Kaylee is here today to set the record straight. By the end of this episode, you will understand the importance of spontaneous awakening trials, how to perform them safely, understanding that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, and how this can totally change the trajectory of our patients' lives. Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years, and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school. Kaylee starts us off by discussing the importance of spontaneous awakening trials and their purpose.
The objective of an awakening trial is to find your patient again, to rehumanize your patient. We should be aspiring to do sedation cessation. When we really understand how dangerous those medications are, even though right now they are so normal throughout most of our ICUs, that doesn't mean they're benign. They come at a high price. Our goal of the bundle should be having patients be as awake, communicative, autonomous, mobile as possible. But if we just automatically sedate them, and whenever sedation's running, it's easy, as we've seen, to sneak that sedation deeper, to misinterpret the RAS, and we set patients up for really poor outcomes.
Kaylee had a similar rocky introduction to spontaneous awakening trials as I did.
So in 2016, when I was in one of the early rollout units for the ABCDF bundle, here's how I was taught to do awakening trials. I wasn't in any formal orientation program. I was just a travel nurse. But the chart nurse said, "Oh yeah, by the way, here we do this really annoying thing. So at 5 a.m, you just turn sedation down enough to see them thrash and then turn it back on. That's how you know they haven't had a stroke, if they move all four, and that they can't tolerate the ventilator, because no one can." That was it. that's not really awakening trials.
Luckily, there is a better approach to awakening trials, as Kaylee explains.
So SCCM, the Society of Critical Care and Medicine, and their ICU Liberation rollout teaches awakening trials to be turning sedation off and seeing how they do. Turn it off, not just sneak it down by 5 micrograms, but turn it off. Now, I will put a clause. If I've heard from a previous shift that they came out with a RASS of +3 or +4 and they're thrashing when sedation was turned off, and we know that they're delirious or things like that, I might approach this differently. I might say, okay, I'm going to wean it down, but I want to work on getting it off. But I'm going to wean it down to see, can I get them to a RASS of 0 or +1 so I can mobilize them? If I know that that's how they've come out before, I'm going to get physical and occupational therapy with me. I'm going to get help so that we can mobilize them. So I'm going to wean it down to the point where they can actually participate with mobility. We're going to mobilize them, wear them out, and then I'm going to see if we still need sedation.
It's important to point out that there are contraindications to spontaneous awakening trials when it's unsafe to turn off sedation.
Sometimes they are necessary. Again, I gave examples like seizures, intracranial hypertension, the inability to oxygenate with movement, RASS of +3 or +4, right? There are times when we need to use it. It's unavoidable. So when those exceptions happen, that's when we need to be asking, is there still an indication for sedation?
Well, let me see if I understand this point here. So there's the kind of classic SAT where you're just knocking off the sedation altogether. You're just turning it off. But you're saying the special case where you know there's this underlying delirium going on that would cause, you know, this thrashing, this +3, +4 of the agitation, then you would titrate down to a RASS instead of just stopping the sedative altogether.
Yeah. And this is like tips by Kaylee, right? Like we know that we should turn it all the way off, right? And for most patients that works, I worry about clinician safety. If we know that they came out at a RASS of +4, but we never really treated that, and then we resumed probably the cause of it, I don't really expect my outcomes to be that different next time I turn it off. So, but I want to treat the cause of it. So what we usually do is we turn it back on, and sometimes we turn it up deeper. So studies have shown that awakening trials, when we turn it off, and then if we're at a RASS of +3 or +4, turn it on at half, over time that decreases the dose of sedation and it improves outcomes. It can decrease time on the ventilator by like 4 days.
It's huge.
Huge, right? So that was the first study for the awakening breathing trials. That was in the early 2000s, right? Again, consider that they were comparing that to high-dose benzodiazepine drips. Their control group was really severe. But nonetheless, it decreased sedation by over 4 days, right? Or time on the ventilator by over 4 days. Okay. About that same time, another group in Canada did a similar trial. So they had a control group doing no sedation vacations or awakening trials, and another group did the awakening trials. They found the opposite. They found that it did not improve outcomes and that the intervention group, the group that was doing the awakening trials, had a higher cumulative dose of midazolam and that it was more work for the nurses. Okay, so how did they do the awakening trials? What was the difference, right? So just because you're doing an awakening trial doesn't mean you're really doing an awakening trial and that you're really having the benefits of it. That team did not have the goal of getting patients awake, mobile, autonomous, communicative, right? They didn't want to work towards sedation cessation. They just saw it as an on and off switch. So when Dr. Ely, the creator of the ADF bundle, went out to this team and he said, how did you guys get those results in that study? Were you really doing awakening trials? They said, yeah, we turned the sedation off. Then they started to move and we turned it back on. There, it was a break. It was a trial. Holiday, interruption, right? All those words, it applied. They did it. They charted it as an SAT. There you go. But because patients came out so agitated, likely because midazolam is such a deliriogenic medication, the patients were probably just so delirious and came out so wild. There's a sense of panic. Like you've got to get control back, right? Because we see unplanned extubations as the worst case scenario, which is a whole nother discussion. But they not only resumed the sedation, but they turned it up even higher in that moment of panic. But then they don't reassess, right? So they're like, whew, they stopped moving. They're comfortable now. They're sleeping. We're good. And so I personally hated awakening trials because it was very similar. I mean, I don't know that I really cranked it up, but you end up going back to it at some point because you don't know what to do with those patients, right? So that's one of the trials, struggles is in really approaching awakening trials appropriately is that we don't fear sedation. We don't aspire to get it off. We don't know why we're doing it. We don't know how to get it off. We don't know what to do when they come out with delirium. And we have really poor team dynamics and support and staffing and things like that that make it really difficult. Now, in contrast, in my experiences in awake and walk in ICU, when we took sedation off right away, when we allowed patients to come out of sedation, so we weren't using paralytics as a standard, so they were able to wake up right after intubation. If you're using paralytics, once the paralytic wears off an hour or two later, when you take it off, it's entirely different. It's like coming out of a colonoscopy. So they come out with like maybe a RASA plus one and plus two, and you can talk them through it and they can acclimate to the tube and it's entirely different. But right now we're setting our teams up for awakening trials that are really difficult because patients have been sedated. We're waiting until ventilator settings are minimal. When really, again, awakening trials should be when there is no longer an indication for sedation with the goal of having patients be awake, autonomous, engaged, active, and be working towards sedation cessation. But right now, many teams, and you have to look at your team's protocols, right? I've seen that they don't allow, in some teams, awakening trials until ventilator settings are low, minimal. That's not founded in the evidence. And when it's that way, it's so hard on the nurses because now you've let them marinate in this neurotoxic, myotoxic medication. Their brains and their bodies are so altered. And then you get to be the one to unmask that and deal with it. And it's really difficult.
Going back to your experience with doing an awakening trial at 5 a.m, I'm just going to kind of think this through a little bit. It seems to me that's not a good time to do an awakening trial because you don't have your physical therapist, your occupational therapist, all the people that could help bring the anxiety level down or bring the RASS score down to something that's tolerable. So at least where I am right now, we do SATs at 8 a.m. because we have our staff there. And I think that's got to make a real difference.
I believe so. That's the first thing I like scrap when it comes to training teams because it's not effective. I mean, there is some research to show that if you do awakening trial and you extubate patients before 9 a.m, it can decrease over a day in the ICU, which is everyone's goal, right? You want to get them off the ventilator, out of the ICU as soon as possible. We know the outcomes will improve. But 5 a.m. when there's no family, a dark room, one lone nurse, it's not effective. And so I think that's where we see this on and off switch of rushing back to turn it back on because it's you just don't have the time in the hands and the right people. So when I maybe have heard that a patient had a poor awakening trial, I'm like, okay, I'm going to make sure the family's right here. Now, you don't have to do an awakening trial only once a day. You can do an awakening trial anytime. That really bothers me too. It's like, well, we'll try again in 24 hours. The patient that you mentioned, why not try again in the afternoon? Why not try again? Like, look at what went wrong. Who do we need? Let's regroup. Let's do it again. Unless maybe they totally desaturated, you know, into the 70s, we might think, okay, what's causing that? Let's treat that and then try when we've addressed the cause, right? But in the case that you shared, you shouldn't have to wait 24 hours to do it again, right? That's dangerous for the patient. So I want to make sure that the family is there. If they're in delirium, or even if they're not, anyone, even in their right mind, they have a tube down their throat, they're usually strapped to the bed, they're in a foreign environment. Even if they didn't have delirium, they lost time, they're disoriented. Having someone that they know, a safe person, their security blanket, like I would want my husband there. I know that that would calm me down. So you have to have, if they have productive, capable family involved, which is most of our patients' case, but not all of them, have them there. Then you as a nurse are not the only one in charge of explaining things to them, reorienting them. Sometimes, especially if they're in delirium, you can say, hey, you have a tube that's helping you breathe. 2 seconds later, it's gone, right? One of the main features of delirium is inattention. They're not going to retain that information. You don't have time to sit there and tell them every time. So you can leave that to the family, but you have to train the family. They're going to be, they're confused. They have delirium. please keep telling them you have a tube down your throat. You can take their cell phones and put the camera on reverse, let them see their own face. That really helps. If someone's like, hey, you have something on your face, what do you want to do? Go look in the mirror. You have something in your teeth, you have to go look in the mirror. But we're like, hey, you have this huge thing strapped to your face, you've got a feeding tube, you've got something poking out of your mouth that you can kind of see. It's so jarring and disorienting. Let them see it. It gives them so much better orientation, understanding. When they understand what's going on, they can protect their own tube. We just need to not take that away from them. When we do that, we make it far more dangerous and harder for them. Delirium increases the risks of them pulling out that tube by over 11 times.
11. Wow.
Yes. We're always talking about unplanned extubations, like you can't, the self-extubations, we're so worried about it. Okay, so then don't set them up to have those. Midazolam is an independent risk factor for an unplanned extubation, and yet many of our teams are still giving midazolam. It's not keeping patients safer. When you're looking at awakening trials, we need to look at the timing of it, what our objective is, and how we're approaching it. So if we're just weaning sedation down enough to see them take some extra breaths over the ventilator, then it's not an effective awakening trial. And if we're failing it just because they've breathed 27 times a minute when they're set to 18 times a minute, that's not a failed trial. That's not appropriate. If we're talking about agitation, if we're saying they were agitated, so they failed the trial, but what was their RASS? Were they a plus one or plus two? Is that really agitation? Or what was the cause? Could we work through that? And if they were a plus three or plus four, did we then have to sedate them down to a plus or a negative three, negative five? Or did we, so the SCCM says turn it off if they have dangerous behaviors, which is RASS plus or plus three or plus four, turn it back on at half. Reevaluate. Again, look at what's your target RASS, probably hopefully a zero or a negative one to a plus one. Within that window, you can mobilize our patients. You can mobilize them at negative two, but why would you do that to yourself? It's more work, right? If they're a negative two because they're delirious and they're not sedated, you can still set them up and they probably perk up and become a zero. But if you're sedating them to a negative two, what are you doing to your PT colleagues? They can't turn down sedation, right? You're setting them up to waste time, to hurt themselves, to have an ineffective session. So everyone needs to work together on this. But the nurses are kind of the linchpin. If nurses are not bought in, the entire team can't do their jobs as well. And to talk to any PT that wants to work with intubated patients, sometimes PTs are the barrier, but usually they're not. They may get the order, they go in, and patient's too sedated. And it's really frustrating, and it causes moral injury to them as well when they have this perspective of wanting to preserve the patient's function and lives, and they're unable to do so. So everyone needs to be working together and supporting each other, and you will find that when you make friends with those PTs and they work with your patients and they wear them out, the patient actually gets real sleep. They're calm. They're so much easier to deal with, and it's more enjoyable. So you come to not see PT as a pest or a barrier, but you see them as your BFF, especially when you have a hard awakening trial. You grab that PTOT and you say, I can't deal with this. I need your help. They come in, they work their magic, and the rest of your shift is easier. And you're hoping to get that patient the next day because they're so nice.
Now, what would you do if you were in the same position as me, in a department that didn't prioritize mobilization? What power do you have as one lone nurse?
So even if your team isn't ready to walk all your patients in the hallway, right? You as a nurse, getting patients to be awake on the ventilator, that alone is drastically increasing their chances to survive and thrive. That is alone is getting them off the ventilator days sooner. It's increasing their chances of going home. It's preserving their brain function. It's preserving their dignity, their autonomy. So don't get frustrated because your team's not ready to go and walk that intubated patient on high ventilator settings yet. But you as a nurse have every right to practice the bundle within your own scope. And awakening trials are your responsibility. And so when you approach them, do it with the goal of really practicing the bundle and that alone. When you have a patient awake and you hand that patient out to the next nurse, there might be some temptation to resedate that patient. Definitely seen it. But it decreases the chances. When you can have a patient saying, no, I don't want to be sedated, you're setting them up to be awake throughout their course and to survive. So you as a nurse have so much power in a patient's outcomes. No pressure.
Isn't that something? Like how much power we have? You know, I think sometimes we fall into this misconception that, oh, we just follow doctor's orders. But especially in this, in the ICU, and particularly with this awakening trial, this is such a crucial moment for nurses to have an impact on their patient's trajectory.
Absolutely. It's like it's determining whether or not they preserve the ability to write. So when we do awakening trials later, after a few days at least, they quickly lose a neuromuscular connection because propofol disrupts the sodium channels in the muscles. So there's like a propofol handwriting. So even if they have muscle mass, I mean, they're young, they've only been sedated for a day, they have a hard time writing legibly. Now they don't have a really clear way of communicating. They can't hold a cell phone. They can't text. Now there are apps and certain technologies that I can get into, but most of our ICUs don't have those. So we quickly take away their voice and their right to communicate with sedation if we don't do awakening trials right away. We quickly allow them to develop delirium. It makes it harder for everybody else. So no pressure on nurses. I don't mean to put this all in nurses. I don't. That's one of my big objectives as a consultant is to say, do not just shove this on the nurses.
I also try to keep in mind that a patient who gets delirium, who is given sedatives, you know, unnecessarily, we're possibly changing the trajectory of their discharge too. And, you know, I don't quite know the stats, but, you know, you're increasing the risk of needing acute rehab, of needing to go to an LTAC. So through the spontaneous awakening trials, you are helping to put that patient on the path to going home, which is where we all want them to go.
When you talk about the statistics, the ADF bundle, even with only 12% out of bed bearing weight, they decreased discharges to anywhere but home by 36%. Patients were 36% more likely to go home. Another study that did better mobility, they found that patients with mobility were 59% more likely to go home. 22.3% were more likely, in another study, were more likely to go home without services, not even home health. So we can greatly determine the trajectory of their hospital course, of their discharge disposition, and their lives. So this is not just another annoying checklist. This is really why we're here.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking the time today to sit down and really go over this. I think it's helpful to talk through, especially the why we're doing this, and which can help guide the how. So thank you, Kaylee, for taking the time.
Absolutely. And I'm happy to send anyone a survey sheet that they can do their own survey within their ICU to see how they're doing.
Ooh, I love that.
You know, one person says, hey, I'm seeing this problem. Everyone will be like, it's not really happening, or it was just that nurse or whatever. And it's not just about one nurse. So when I go to work with teams, I want to understand where their gaps are, where they're currently at, where their baseline is, right? So one of the things that I do is have them go out and do that same survey that the student nurse did to say, how accurate are our RAS scores? Because we can look into the computer and say, oh, look, you know, like 60% of our patients are at a -2. We're lightly sedating our patients. That's fine. But they're not really at the bedside. So we need to know how much we can rely on that data to know if we're really compliant with the bundle.
Totally. Is that something you'd be willing to share with me? I could put in the show notes as like a link to sure. To the
Yeah, it's simple. It's just an Excel sheet.
Excel sheet.
Let's do it.
Great. Yep. Awesome. All right, Kaylee, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Yep, we'll talk soon.
I'll take this moment to let you all know that I decided to step down from the ICU training program. While I respect nurses who choose to work in the ICU, I realized that it wasn't a good cultural or personality fit for me. It had been my goal for years to transition to critical care. So let me tell you, it has been a big change in plans for me. I don't know if I will pursue it again. But for now, I will be stepping into a new role as a clinical instructor for the university where I went to nursing school. Thought you all might like to know that little update. I try not to get too personal on this podcast, but given the subject matter we had been discussing, I thought I'd let you know. All right. I hope this episode has been helpful. If you find value in it, please, please leave me a 5-star rating and even better, a review where you get your podcasts. Until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.